watches. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WXXE Fenner Syracuse, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, KWMD Kosilov Anchorage, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, Radio Veronica, U.S., WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, or WMRW Warren. You're not tuned to WEOS Geneva or 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio because Unwelcome Guests has been preempted by WEOS for holiday programming. So in order not to deprive my local listeners of one of the most important things that has been offered on the show, I've decided to postpone the readings of the Underground History of Education for 2 weeks until the program resumes on WEOS. I apologize to the rest of you for this. I was faced with a set of unsatisfactory choices. So this week, in my version of holiday programming, we're going to look at one of the greatest mechanisms of social control, oppression, and violence in human history, religion, in particular what are called the monotheistic religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. While I know many good people who follow these religions, maybe that includes you, and who do good work in the world under their inspiration, they say, this is the exception rather than the rule in my experience. I realized I did not believe in God when I was 7 years old. I didn't know that there were others who felt the same way. I knew I was supposed to believe in God, but I just didn't. One thing that led to my disbelief was the obvious lie that women were inferior to men, and the contemptuous attitude toward women, supposedly ordained by God the Father. Had I been conceptualizing God, she would have been a grandmother. Like mine, who worked miracles in the kitchen on a daily basis, in much the same manner as God was supposed to have created the world, a pinch of this, a dash of that. Then there was the matter of genocide, slavery, and starvation. How could an all-powerful and just God allow this to happen, not just once, but constantly, to people who did nothing to deserve such a cruel fate? And how could this one God allow people to kill each other over which God to believe in if there was only one God? And why a commandment not to worship other gods if there weren't any other gods? This really made no sense at all. Surely, God could just appear to everyone and say, "Hey, I'm the only God there is. Stop fighting." I came up with 3 possible explanations for God's failure to act. 1, there was no God. Or 2, this God was a monster who had the power to prevent suffering, but refused to use it. Or 3, there really were many gods, and this God was not so all-powerful as he claimed. I beg God to tell me the truth. After all, for an omnipotent, omniscient, and omnipresent being, taking a moment to resolve my crisis of faith should not have been a big deal. No response from God. Oh yeah, that's right, he hates girls, because they fancy a taste from the tree of knowledge. Kinda insecure for such an omnipotent guy, isn't he? And he even cursed Eve for wanting knowledge, so that bearing children would thenceforth be misery. And that's why, to this day, the churches who oppose birth control and abortion, no matter what reason they give, I think have one real agenda: to make sure that women experience the maximum misery. Bastards. I truly don't understand how women can be part of a religion whose fundamental text is such a piece of sadistic, patriarchal smut. And I'm not exaggerating. The program you will hear this week will include readings from the so-called Good Book, which include fathers impregnating their daughters, killing them and cooking them as offerings to God, or offering them up to a mob to be gang-raped. What is amazing is that we permit ourselves to be bullied by sanctimonious people who rail about the flash of a woman's breast on a TV screen, or strive to censor the internet in the name of protecting children, yet desire to indoctrinate children with a text replete with such stomach-turning perversion. I'm amazed that monotheism caught on in such a big way. Of the three possibilities, no God, one God, or many gods, the one God was the hardest for me to believe. The Bible said we were made in the image of God. But we weren't all-powerful, all-knowing, and everywhere at the same time. Then I found a book at the library on Greek myths. It was a revelation. Here were many gods, and we seemed to be made in their images. For one thing, some of the gods were women. Different women and different men who battled against one another and got humans involved. There I discovered the goddess of wisdom, Athena. Here, a woman of wisdom was worshipped, not punished. Perhaps I had the key to the first commandment. It was a cover-up, so that we would not find out there were other gods out there whose worship was a lot more fun. But Athena wouldn't speak to me either, and I was led by process of elimination to the only possible conclusion. Choice number one, no gods. I know that many people belong to churches in order to have a sense of community and purpose. We need that as human beings, especially in a society that reduces us to atomized units of consumption. I think that this is what is responsible for the rise of fundamentalism, as a reaction to that. I've been to evangelical churches. The unbelievable doctrine aside, they offer their members a sense of being a valued part of something. They take care of each other. We don't need a bunch of absurd dogma to live lives that mean something. Love, beauty, and pride in the work of one's hands and mind offer all the happiness we need. What we need is a society that allows us to have that, and the work of bringing that society into being offers meaning and purpose enough. We can love each other without religion. In fact, we can love each other better when religions don't stand between us, exhorting us to hate non-believers and oppress women, who are, after all, more than half of humanity. It is time to cast off gods and masters, to put up Christmas trees just because they're beautiful, to give gifts just because it makes us happy, and to recognize we are in the Garden of Eden already, planet Earth, and to care for it as such a wondrous home deserves. Now, for a serious mano a mano, in The Ring for the Free, Professor Richard Dawkins of Oxford University, in The Opposite Corner for the Faithful, various faculty and students of Jerry Falwell's Liberty University in Lynchburg, Virginia. The talk was recorded in Lynchburg, Virginia, at Randolph Macon Women's College during Dawkins' fall book tour for his latest work, The God Delusion.
Good evening. My name is Douglas Shedd. I'm a professor of biology at Randolph Macon Women's College, and I would like to welcome to the college and to this year's Philip Thayer Memorial Lecture. This lectureship was established by the colleagues and friends of Philip Thayer, the late Theodore Jack Professor of History at Randolph Macon Women's College, in recognition of his long service to the college. I was fortunate to have known Professor Thayer. He was a wonderful, larger-than-life free thinker, and he would have been delighted by the person who will deliver the Thayer Memorial Lecture this evening. This person is, of course, Richard Dawkins, the Charles Simonyi Professor in the Public Understanding of Science at Oxford University. Professor Dawkins was born in Nairobi, Kenya, and moved with his family to England when he was seven. He studied zoology at Oxford, where he was tutored by Nobel Prize-winning Nico Tinbergen and earned his doctorate at Oxford. Between 1967 and 1969, Professor Dawkins was an assistant professor of zoology at the University of California, Berkeley. In 1970, he was appointed a lecturer, and then in 1990, a reader in zoology at the University of Oxford, before becoming the university's first Charles Simonyi Professor in the Public Understanding of Science in 1995. Professor Dawkins has been a fellow of New College, Oxford, since 1970. This year marks the 30th anniversary of Professor Dawkins's landmark book, The Selfish Gene. In this book, Professor Dawkins explained to a popular audience many important new ideas in evolutionary biology, and did so in a way so insightful that the book influenced how a generation of scientists think about evolution. The book is truly a classic in modern scientific literature. Professor Dawkins followed the selfish gene with a remarkable series of books, including The Extended Phenotype, The Blind Watchmaker, my personal favorite, River Out of Eden, Climbing Mount Improbable, Unweaving the Rainbow, A Devil's Chaplain, The Ancestor's Tale, and most recently, The God Delusion. The Wall Street Journal said Professor Dawkins' passion is supported by an awe-inspiring literary craftsmanship, and the New York Times Book Review has hailed him as a writer who understands the issues so clearly that he forces his readers to understand them too. Professor Dawkins' awards include the Silver Medal of the Zoological Society of London, the Royal Society's Michael Faraday Award, the Nakayama Prize for Achievement in Human Science, the International Cosmos Prize, and the Kistler's Prize. He has honorary doctorates in both literature and science, and is a fellow of the Royal Society. Professor Dawkins is an outspoken commentator on science, politics, and religion, and among the world's best-known public intellectuals. We are delighted to have him here this evening to discuss his new book, The God Delusion. Professor Dawkins.
Thank you very much. Is this microphone working? I hope and expect that the high spot of the evening will be when you get to talk in the question and answer session. But before that, you'll have to listen to me for a bit while I read just a few passages from my latest book, The God Delusion, to set the scene for the questions. I'm going to begin with the opening of the book from chapter 1, A Deeply Religious Non-Believer. The boy lay prone in the grass, his chin resting on his hands. He suddenly found himself overwhelmed by a heightened awareness of the tangled stems and roots, a forest in microcosm, a transfigured world of ants and beetles, and even, though he wouldn't have known the details at the time, of soil bacteria by the billions, silently and invisibly shoring up the economy of the microworld. Suddenly, the microforest of the turf seemed to swell and become one with the universe, and with the rapt mind of the boy contemplating it. He interpreted the experience in religious terms, and it led him eventually to the priesthood. He was ordained an Anglican priest and became a chaplain at my school, a teacher of whom I was fond. In another time and place, that boy could have been me under the stars, dazzled by Orion, Cassiopeia, and Ursa Major, tearful with the unheard music of the Milky Way, heady with the night scents of frangipani and trumpet flowers in an African garden. Why the same emotion should have led my chaplain in one direction and me in the other is not an easy question to answer. A quasi-mystical response to nature and the universe is common among scientists and rationalists. It has no connection with supernatural belief. I often hear myself described as a deeply religious man. An American student wrote to me that she had asked her professor whether he had a view about me. "Sure," he replied, "he's positive science is incompatible with religion, but he waxes ecstatic about nature and the universe. To me, that is religion." But is religion the right word? I don't think so. Much unfortunate confusion is caused by failure to distinguish what can be called Einsteinian religion from supernatural religion. Einstein sometimes invoked the name of God, and he's not the only atheistic scientist to do so, inviting misunderstanding by supernaturalists eager to misunderstand and claim so illustrious a thinker as their own. The dramatic, or was it mischievous, ending of Stephen Hawking's A Brief History of Time, "For then we should know the mind of God," is notoriously misconstrued. It has led people to believe, mistakenly of course, that Hawking is a religious man. Great scientists of our time who sound religious usually turn out not to be so when you examine their beliefs more deeply. This is certainly true of Einstein and Hawking. One of Einstein's most eagerly quoted remarks is, "Science without religion is lame. Religion without science is blind." But Einstein also said, "It was, of course, a lie what you read about my religious convictions, a lie which is being systematically repeated. I do not believe in a personal God, and I have never denied this, but have expressed it clearly. If something is in me which can be called religious, then it is the unbounded admiration for the structure of the world, so far as our science can reveal it." Does it seem that Einstein contradicted himself? That his words can be cherry-picked for quotes to support both sides of an argument? No. By religion, Einstein meant something entirely different from what is conventionally meant. As I continue to clarify the distinction between supernatural religion on the one hand and Einsteinian religion on the other, bear in mind that I am calling only supernatural gods delusional. That's the end of the extract from chapter 1. Now, an extract from chapter 2, the God hypothesis. The God of the Old Testament is arguably the most unpleasant character in all fiction. Jealous and proud of it. A petty, unjust, unforgiving control freak. A vindictive, bloodthirsty ethnic cleanser, a misogynistic, homophobic, racist, infanticidal, genocidal, filicidal, pestilential, megalomaniacal, sadomasochistic, capriciously malevolent bully. Those of us schooled from infancy in his ways can become desensitized to their horror. A naïf, blessed with a perspective of innocence, has a clearer perception. Winston Churchill's son, Randolph, somehow contrived to remain ignorant of scripture until Evelyn Waugh and a brother officer, in a vain attempt to keep Churchill quiet when they were posted together during the war, bet him he couldn't read the entire Bible in a fortnight. Unhappily, it has not had the result we hoped. He has never read any of it before and is hideously excited, keeps reading quotations aloud. "I say, I bet you didn't know this came in the Bible." Or merely slapping his side and chortling, "God, isn't God a sh-?" Thomas Jefferson, better read, was of a similar opinion. "The Christian God is a being of terrific character, cruel, vindictive, capricious and unjust." It is unfair to attack such an easy target. The God hypothesis should not stand or fall with its most unlovely instantiation, Yahweh, nor his insipidly opposite Christian face, gentle Jesus, meek and mild. To be fair, this milksop persona owes more to his Victorian followers than to Jesus himself. Could anything be more mawkishly nauseating than Mrs. C.F. Alexander's "Christian children all must be mild, obedient, good as he"? I am not attacking the particular qualities of Yahweh or Jesus or Allah or any other specific god, such as Baal, Zeus or Wotan. Instead, I shall define the God hypothesis more defensively. There exists a superhuman, supernatural intelligence who deliberately designed and created the universe and everything in it, including us. This book will advocate an alternative view. Any creative intelligence of sufficient complexity to design anything comes into existence only as the end product of an extended process of gradual evolution. Creative intelligences being evolved necessarily arrive late in the universe and therefore cannot be responsible for designing it. God, in the sense defined, is a delusion, and as later chapters will show, a pernicious delusion. Not surprisingly, since it is founded on local traditions of private revelation rather than evidence, the God hypothesis comes in many versions. Historians of religion recognize a progression from primitive tribal animisms through polytheisms such as those of the Greeks, Romans, and Norsemen to monotheisms such as Judaism and its derivatives, Christianity and Islam. Christianity claims to be a monotheistic religion. But you have to wonder sometimes. Rivers of medieval ink, not to mention blood, have been squandered over the mystery of the Trinity and in suppressing deviations such as the Arian heresy. Arius of Alexandria, in the 4th century AD, denied that Jesus was consubstantial, i.e. of the same substance or essence, with God. What on earth could this possibly mean, you're probably asking? Substance? What substance? What exactly do you mean by essence? Very little seems the only reasonable reply. Yet the controversy split Christendom down the middle for a century, and the Emperor Constantine ordered that all copies of Arius's book should be burned. Splitting Christendom by splitting hairs, such has ever been the way of theology. Do we have one God in three parts, or three gods in one? The Catholic Encyclopedia clears up the matter for us in a masterpiece of theological close reasoning. In the unity of the Godhead there are three persons, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, these three persons being truly distinct, one from another. Thus, in the words of the Athanasian Creed, the Father is God, the Son is God, and the Holy Spirit is God, and yet there are not three gods, but one God. As if that were not clear enough, the Encyclopedia quotes the 3rd-century theologian St. Gregory the Miracle Worker. There is therefore nothing created, nothing subject to another in the Trinity, nor is there anything that has been added as though it once had not existed, but had entered afterwards. Therefore the Son has never been without the Father, nor the Son without the Spirit, and this same Trinity is immutable and unalterable forever. Whatever miracles may have earned St. Gregory his nickname, they were not miracles of honest lucidity. His words convey the characteristically obscurantist flavour of theology, which, unlike science or most other branches of human scholarship, has not moved on in 18 centuries. Thomas Jefferson, as so often, got it right when he said, "Ridicule is the only weapon which can be used against unintelligible propositions. Ideas must be distinct before reason can act upon them, and no man ever had a distinct idea of the Trinity. It is the mere abracadabra of the mountebanks calling themselves the priests of Jesus." Jefferson heaped ridicule on the doctrine that, as he put it, there are three gods in his critique of Calvinism. But it is especially the Roman Catholic branch of Christianity that pushes its recurrent flirtation with polytheism towards runaway inflation. The Trinity is, joined by Mary, Queen of Heaven, a goddess in all but name, who surely runs God himself a close second as a target of prayers. The pantheon is further swollen by an army of saints, whose intercessory power makes them, if not demigods, well worth approaching on their own specialist subjects. The Catholic Community Forum helpfully lists 5,120 saints, together with their areas of expertise, which include abdominal pains, abuse victims, anorexia, arms dealers, blacksmiths, broken bones, bomb technicians, and bowel disorders, to venture no further than the bees. Pope John Paul II created more saints than all his predecessors of the past several centuries put together, and he had a special affinity with the Virgin Mary. His polytheistic hankerings were dramatically demonstrated in 1981 when he suffered an assassination attempt in Rome and attributed his survival to intervention by Our Lady of Fatima. A maternal hand guided the bullet. One cannot help wondering why she didn't guide it to miss him altogether. Others might think the team of surgeons who operated on him for 6 hours deserved at least a share of the credit. But perhaps their hands, too, were maternally guided. The relevant point is that it wasn't just Our Lady who, in the Pope's opinion, guided the bullet, but specifically Our Lady of Fatima. Presumably Our Lady of Lourdes, Our Lady of Guadalupe, Our Lady of Medjugorje, Our Lady of Akita, Our Lady of Zaytun, Our Lady of Garabandal, and Our Lady of Knock were busy on other errands at the time. Well, chapter 3 debunks the arguments for the existence of God. Leaving that on one side, chapter 4, why there almost certainly is no God, is hard to compress into a brief reading, and I'll have to leave that as well. Chapter 5 is about the interesting question of why people are religious, because actually most people are. Chapter 6, and why are most people moral to the extent that people are. Chapter 7, the good book and the changing moral zeitgeist. I shall read a little bit from that. I'm keeping a tally of the people walking out. I think it's about 3 or 4 so far. There are 2 ways in which scripture might be a source of morals or rules for living. One is by direct instruction, for example, through the 10 commandments, which are the subject of such bitter contention in the culture wars of America's boondocks. The other is by example. God or some other biblical character might serve as, to use the contemporary jargon, a role model. Both scriptural roots, if followed through religiously, encourage a system of morals which any civilized modern person, whether religious or not, would find, I can put it no more gently, obnoxious. Abraham was the founding father of all 3 great monotheistic religions. His patriarchal status renders him only somewhat less likely than God to be taken as a role model. But what modern moralist would wish to follow him? God ordered Abraham to make a burnt offering of his longed-for son. Abraham built an altar, put firewood upon it, and trussed Isaac up on top of the wood. His murdering knife was already in his hand when an angel dramatically intervened with the news of a last-minute change of plan. God was only joking, after all. Tempting Abraham and testing his faith. A modern moralist cannot help but wonder how a child could ever recover from such psychological trauma. By the standards of modern morality, this disgraceful story is an example simultaneously of child abuse, bullying in 2 asymmetrical power relationships, and the first recorded use of the Nuremberg defense. I was only obeying orders. Yet the legend is one of the great foundational myths of all 3 monotheistic religions. Modern theologians will protest that the story of Abraham sacrificing Isaac should not be taken as literal fact. And the appropriate response is twofold. First, many, many people, even to this day, do take the whole of their scripture to be literal fact. And they have a great deal of political power over the rest of us, especially in the United States and in the Islamic world. Second, if not as literal fact, how should we take the story? As an allegory? Then an allegory for what? Surely nothing praiseworthy. As a moral lesson? But what kind of morals could one derive from this appalling story? Remember, all I'm trying to establish for the moment is that we do not, as a matter of fact, derive our morals from scripture. Or if we do, we pick and choose among the scriptures for the nice bits and reject the nasty. But then we must have some independent criterion for deciding which are the moral bits, a criterion which, wherever it comes from, cannot come from scripture itself, and is presumably available to all of us, whether we are religious or not. Apologists even seek to salvage some decency for the God character in this deplorable tale. Wasn't it good of God to spare Isaac's life at the last minute? In the unlikely event that any of my readers are persuaded by this obscene piece of special pleading, I refer them to another story of human sacrifice which ended more unhappily. In Judges chapter 11, the military leader Jephthah made a bargain with God that if God would guarantee Jephthah's victory over the Ammonites, Jephthah would, without fail, sacrifice as a burnt offering whatsoever cometh forth of the doors of my house to meet me when I return. Jephthah did indeed defeat the Ammonites with a very great slaughter, as is par for the course in the book of Judges, and he returned home victorious. Not surprisingly, his daughter, his only child, came out of the house to greet him with timbrels and dances. And alas, she was the first living thing to do so. Understandably, Jephthah rent his clothes, but there was nothing he could do about it. God was obviously looking forward to the promised burnt offering, and in the circumstances, the daughter very decently agreed to be sacrificed. She asked only that she should be allowed to go into the mountains for 2 months to bewail her virginity. At the end of this time, she meekly returned, and Jephthah cooked her. God did not see fit to intervene on this occasion.
In the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, the Noah equivalent, chosen to be spared with his family because he was uniquely righteous, was Abraham's nephew Lot. Two male angels were sent to Sodom to warn Lot to leave the city before the brimstone arrived. Lot hospitably welcomed the angels into his house, whereupon all the men of Sodom gathered around and demanded that Lot should hand the angels over so that they could, what else, sodomize them. Where are the men which came into thee this night? Bring them out unto us, that we may know them. Genesis 19:5. Yes, know has the authorized version's usual euphemistic meaning, which is very funny in the context. Lot's gallantry in refusing the demand suggests that God might have been on to something when he singled him out as the only good man in Sodom. But Lot's halo is tarnished by the terms of his refusal. I pray you, brethren, do not so wickedly. Behold now, I have two daughters which have not known man. Let me, I pray you, bring them out unto you. And do ye unto them as is good in your eyes. Only unto these men do nothing, for therefore came they under the shadow of my roof. Genesis 19:7-8. Whatever else this strange story might mean, it surely tells us something about the respect accorded to women in this intensely religious culture. As it happened, Lot's bargaining away of his daughter's virginity proved unnecessary, for the angels succeeded in repelling the marauders by miraculously striking them blind. They then warned Lot to decamp immediately with his family and his animals, because the city was about to be destroyed. The whole household escaped, with the exception of Lot's unfortunate wife, whom the Lord turned into a pillar of salt, because she committed the offence, comparatively mild, one might have thought, of looking over her shoulder at the fireworks display. Lot's two daughters make a brief reappearance in the story. After their mother was turned into a pillar of salt, they lived with their father in a cave up a mountain. Starved of male company, they decided to make their father drunk and copulate with him. Lot was beyond noticing when his elder daughter arrived in his bed or when she left, but he was not too drunk to impregnate her. The next night, the two daughters agreed it was the younger one's turn. Again, Lot was too drunk to notice, and he impregnated her too. Genesis 19:31-6. If this dysfunctional family was the best Sodom had to offer by way of morals... one might begin to feel a certain sympathy with God and his judicial brimstone. The story of Lot and the Sodomites is eerily echoed in chapter 19 of the book of Judges, where an unnamed Levite priest was travelling with his concubine in Gibeah. They spent the night in the house of a hospitable old man. While they were eating their supper, the men of the city came and beat on the door, demanding that the old man should hand over his male guest, so that we may know him. In almost exactly the same words as Lot, the old man said, "Nay, my brethren, nay, I pray you, do not so wickedly. Seeing that this man is come into mine house, do not this folly. Behold, here is my daughter, a maiden, and his concubine. Them I will bring out now, and humble ye them, and do with them what seemeth good unto you. But unto this man do not so vile a thing." Judges 19:23-4.
God's monumental rage whenever his chosen people flirted with a rival god resembles nothing so much as sexual jealousy of the worst kind, and again it should strike a modern moralist as far from good role model material. The temptation to sexual infidelity is readily understandable, even to those who do not succumb, and it's a staple of fiction and drama from Shakespeare to bedroom farce. But the apparently irresistible temptation to whore with foreign gods is something we moderns find harder to empathize with. To my naive eyes, "Thou shalt have no other gods but me" would seem an easy enough commandment to keep. A doddle, one might think, compared with "Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife," or her ass. or her ox. Yet, throughout the Old Testament, with the same predictable regularity as in bedroom farce, God had only to turn his back for a moment, and the children of Israel would be off and at it with Baal or some trollop of a graven image. Or, on one calamitous occasion, a golden calf. There then follows a section on Moses, which I'm going to cut. Go on to the end of the Moses section. The ethnic cleansing begun in the time of Moses is brought to bloody fruition in the book of Joshua, a text remarkable for the bloodthirsty massacres it records and the xenophobic relish with which it does so. As the charming old song exultantly has it, Joshua fit the battle of Jericho and the walls came a-tumbling down. There's none like good old Joshua at the battle of Jericho. Good old Joshua didn't rest until they utterly destroyed all that was in the city, both man and woman, young and old, and ox and sheep and ass, with the edge of the sword. Joshua 6:21. Yet again, theologians will protest it didn't happen. Well, no. The story has it that the walls came tumbling down at the mere sound of men shouting and blowing horns. So indeed, it didn't happen. But that is not the point. The point is that whether true or not, the Bible is held up to us as the source of our morality. And the Bible story of Joshua's destruction of the Lebensraum of Jericho and the invasion of the Promised Land in general is morally indistinguishable from Hitler's invasion of Poland or Saddam Hussein's massacres of the Kurds and the Marsh Arabs. The Bible may be an arresting and poetic work of fiction, but it is not the sort of book you should give your children to form their morals. As it happens, the story of Joshua in Jericho is the subject of an interesting experiment in child morality by the Israeli psychologist George Tamarin. Tamarin presented to more than 1,000 Israeli schoolchildren aged between 8 and 14 the book of Joshua's account of the Battle of Jericho. He then asked the children a simple moral question. Do you think Joshua and the Israelites acted rightly or not? They had to choose between A, total approval, B, partial approval, and C, total disapproval. The results were polarized. 66% gave total approval and 26% total disapproval, with rather fewer, 8%, in the middle with partial approval. Here are three typical answers from the total approval A group. In my opinion, Joshua and the sons of Israel acted well. And here are the reasons. God promised them this land and gave them permission to conquer. If they would not have acted in this manner or killed anyone, then there would be the danger that the sons of Israel would have assimilated among the Goyim. In my opinion, Joshua was right when he did it, one reason being that God commanded him to exterminate the people so that the tribes of Israel will not be able to assimilate amongst them and learn their bad ways. Joshua did good, because the people who inhabited the land were of a different religion. And when Joshua killed them, he wiped their religion from the earth. The justification for the genocidal massacre by Joshua is religious in every case. Even those in category C who gave total disapproval did so in some cases for backhanded religious reasons. One girl, for example, disapproved of Joshua's conquering Jericho because in order to do so, he had to enter it. I think it is bad since the Arabs are impure, and if one enters an impure land, one will also become impure and share their curse. Tamarin ran a fascinating control group in his experiment. A different group of 168 Israeli children were given the same text from the book of Joshua, but with Joshua's own name replaced by General Lin and Israel replaced by a Chinese kingdom 3,000 years ago. Now the experiment gave opposite results. Only 7% approved of General Lin's behavior and 75% disapproved. In other words, when their loyalty to Judaism was removed from the calculation, the majority of the children agreed with the moral judgments that most modern humans would share. Joshua's action was a deed of barbaric genocide. but it all looks different from a religious point of view. And the difference starts early in life. It was religion that made the difference between the children condemning genocide and condoning it. Do those people who hold up the Bible as an inspiration to moral rectitude have the slightest notion of what is actually written in it? The following offences merit the death penalty according to Leviticus 20. Cursing your parents, committing adultery, making love to your stepmother or your daughter-in-law, homosexuality, marrying a woman and her daughter, bestiality, and to add injury to insult, the unfortunate beast is to be killed too. You also get executed, of course, for working on the Sabbath. The point is made again and again throughout the Old Testament. In Numbers 15, the children of Israel found a man in the wilderness gathering sticks on the forbidden day. They arrested him and then asked God what to do with him. As it turned out, God was in no mood for half measures that day. And the Lord said unto Moses, "The man shall surely be put to death. All the congregation shall stone him with stones without the camp." And all the congregation brought him without the camp and stoned him with stones, and he died. Did this harmless gatherer of firewood have a wife and children to grieve for him? Did he whimper with fear as the first stones flew and scream with pain as the fusillade crashed into his head? What shocks me today about such stories is not that they really happened. They probably didn't. What makes my jaw drop is that people today should base their lives on such an appalling role model as Yahweh, and even worse, that they should bossily try to force the same evil monster, whether fact or fiction, on the rest of us. I'm going to skip the remaining chapters now to the last chapter, the very last section of the last chapter, the mother of all burkas. One of the unhappiest spectacles to be seen on our streets today is the image of a woman swathed in shapeless black from head to toe, peering out at the world through a tiny slit. I should say that the streets that I normally walk are the streets of England. It probably isn't the case here. The burqa is not just an instrument of oppression of women and claustral repression of their liberty and their beauty, not just a token of egregious male cruelty and tragically cowed female submission. I want to use the narrow slit in the veil as a symbol of something else. Our eyes see the world through a narrow slit in the electromagnetic spectrum. Visible light is a chink of brightness in the vast dark spectrum, from radio waves at the long end to gamma rays at the short end. Quite how narrow is hard to appreciate and a challenge to convey. Imagine a giant black burqa with a vision slit of approximately the standard width, say about 1 inch. If the length of black cloth above the slit represents the shortwave end of the invisible spectrum, and if the length of black cloth below the slit represents the longwave portion of the invisible spectrum, how long would the burqa have to be in order to accommodate a 1-inch slit to the same scale? It's hard to represent it sensibly without invoking logarithmic scales, so huge are the lengths we're dealing with. The last chapter of a book like this is no place to start tossing logarithms around, but you can take it from me that it would be the mother of all burqas. The 1-inch window of visible light is derisorily tiny compared with the miles and miles of black cloth representing the invisible part of the spectrum, from radio waves at the hem of the skirt to gamma rays at the top of the head. What science does for us is to widen the window. It opens up so wide that the imprisoning black garment drops away almost completely, exposing our senses to airy and exhilarating freedom. Optical telescopes use glass lenses and mirrors to scan the heavens, and what they see is stars that happen to be radiating in the narrow band of wavelengths that we call visible light. But other telescopes see in the X-ray or radio wavelengths and present to us a cornucopia of alternative night skies. On a smaller scale, cameras with appropriate filters can see in the ultraviolet and take photographs of flowers that show an alien range of stripes and spots that are visible to and seemingly designed for insect eyes, but which our unaided eyes can't see at all. Insect eyes have a spectral window of similar width to ours, but slightly shifted up the Broca. They are blind to red, and they see further into the ultraviolet than we do, into the ultraviolet garden. The metaphor of the narrow window of light broadening out into a spectacularly wide spectrum serves us in other areas of science. We live near the center of a cavernous museum of magnitudes, viewing the world with sense organs and nervous systems that are equipped to perceive and understand only a small middle range of sizes, moving at a middle range of speeds. We are at home with objects ranging in size from a few kilometers, the view from a mountaintop, to about a tenth of a millimeter, the point of a pin. Outside this range, even our imagination is handicapped, and we need the help of instruments and of mathematics, which fortunately we can learn to deploy. The range of sizes, distances, or speeds with which our imaginations are comfortable is a tiny band set in the midst of a gigantic range of the possible, from the scale of quantum strangeness at the smaller end to the scale of Einsteinian cosmology at the larger. Our imaginations are forlornly under-equipped to cope with distances outside the narrow middle range of the ancestrally familiar. We try to visualize an electron as a tiny ball in orbit around a larger cluster of balls representing protons and neutrons. That isn't what it is like at all. Electrons are not like little balls. They are not like anything we recognize. It isn't clear that like even means anything when we try to fly too close to reality's further horizons. Our imaginations are not yet tooled up to penetrate the neighborhood of the quantum. Nothing at that scale behaves in the way matter, as we are evolved to think, ought to behave. Nor can we cope with the behavior of objects that move at some appreciable fraction of the speed of light. Common sense lets us down, because common sense evolved in a world where nothing moves very fast and nothing is very small or very large. The mundane world of the familiar, which I have dubbed middle world. At the end of a famous essay on possible worlds, the great biologist J.B.S. Haldane wrote, "Now my own suspicion is that the universe is not only queerer than we suppose, but queerer than we can suppose. I suspect that there are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamed of or can be dreamed of in any philosophy." How should we interpret Haldane's queerer than we can suppose? Queerer than can in principle be supposed, or just queerer than we can suppose, given the limitation of our brain's evolutionary apprenticeship in middle world? Could we, by training and practice, emancipate ourselves from middle world, tear off our black burqa, and achieve some sort of intuitive, as well as just mathematical, understanding of the very small, the very large, and the very fast? I genuinely don't know the answer, but I'm thrilled to be alive at a time when humanity is pushing against the limits of understanding. Even better, we may eventually discover that there are no limits. Thank you very much.
This is Unwelcome Guests. You're tuned to WXXE Fenner Syracuse, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, KWMD Kosilov Anchorage, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, or WMRW Warren. We're listening to Professor Richard Dawkins, author of The God Delusion. We return with a question period.
Hello. I'm Dr. Howell. It's good to have heard your talk. I really appreciated hearing this. I should like to hear more of you. Because the more you talk, the more you convince me that there is a God and you crystallize our need for him.
I'm glad I have some effect, haven't I?
As a scientist, I'm a bit upset by the fact that you would go on a 40-minute tirade against God and then begin talking of science as if to put the authority of science into what you said. But I do have a question about your long discussion about morality. and it coming from the Bible, and that you accuse people, I suppose Christians, of saying that we get our morality from the scriptures. But clearly this cannot be the case, because humanity from every civilization throughout time has a sense of morality, and clearly most of them have not had access to the Bible. So I'm curious then what you think is the origin of this morality. If someone comes in here with a gun and begins shooting all of us, we would call that bad. Why? Why is that bad?
I think we probably agree that people don't, as a matter of fact, get their morality from scriptures, and that's what I was actually saying. People get their morality from somewhere quite other than the scriptures. And to the extent that they do get their morality from the scriptures, as I was saying, they pick and choose. Now, if you're asking me where we get our morality from, I think that's an extremely complicated question, and one that I'm very interested in. I've got a whole chapter on it in the book, which I didn't have time to read from. I think that a sort of bedrock of it probably comes from our Darwinian heritage as a kind of misfiring byproduct of our Darwinian past, when we lived in small villages or small roving bands, which meant that we were surrounded by close kin, and that, as you no doubt know, is one good prerequisite for the evolution of altruism under Darwinian rules. And also, in those small villages or roving bands, we would have been surrounded by people whom we are likely to meet again and again throughout our life, which provides the basis for the other main Darwinian reason to be moral or altruistic. That, I think, is the Darwinian origin, and I suspect that although we no longer live in small bands, the same rules of thumb, which were honed in our Darwinian past, are playing themselves out under the alien conditions of modern urban society. The rule of thumb used to be nice to everyone you meet, because everyone you meet is likely to be either a cousin and or somebody you're going to meet again and again, and therefore in a position to reciprocate. Darwinism doesn't suggest that we should be all wise and do what is actually going to be best for our selfish genes. Instead, it says that it builds into our brains rules of thumb which worked in our ancestral past. That rule of thumb, be nice to everybody, is still in our brains. It is a lust which is rather similar to the sexual lust, which is still in our brains, even though we may use contraception and therefore are not actually using copulation to reproduce. The same rule of thumb persists, and that is also true of the lust to be good, the lust to be nice. That, I think, is the Darwinian origin. But I think that it's become modified and refined through culture, through civilization, until it shows itself in the much more sophisticated and actually much more pleasant rules for being nice that we see today. Wherever else it comes from, it certainly doesn't come from scripture, and that was the only point I was trying to make from that particular reading. Yes.
Well, hello there. Oh, welcome to America. I've been reading your book. I've been reading your book, and I think you're a terrific writer. And I got to say, listening to you in person and that accent and everything, man, I just think you're brilliant. But
I thought there'd be a but, yes.
I know. Well, it's Lynchburg. Well, I am a theist. You'll be disappointed to know, but Bertrand Russell, you know, said that if he faced God, he'd ask, you know, where, you know, he didn't give enough evidence. Where was the evidence on it? A couple pieces of evidence that I would just kind of be interested to hear what you think about pertaining to this issue of ethics. I read this chapter on ethics in your book. I found it interesting. I mean, you were dealing with the origin of our moral sense, more so than, I think, the origin of morality itself. You'd probably agree, right? So you still wonder, what is it about the world that makes some things, you know, right and some things wrong? Some things good, some things bad. And you know, you want to retain the language of some things are evil. And you give a lot of religious examples. And I'm in agreement with you on some of that, you know. But if we're going to retain these categories, these very strong, you know, moral categories, It seems to me that naturalism is going to be very hard-pressed to kind of provide an account for where real good and evil would be. I mean, I'm not sure how entirely we can simply assert the existence of value without providing a deeper account for it. And one other, moral freedom as well. It seems to me that if the naturalist is kind of shackled, you know, I mean, a naturalistic world, it would seem as if we're just bound and determined to behave just the way that we do. If morality is all about ought and ought implies can, how can we ever do anything other than exactly what it is that we do? So I'd be real interested in your responses to those things.
Well, I think it's a problem for all of us. I mean, not just for naturalists. I think it is actually fairly baffling where our morality comes from and why we're in fact as nice as we are. I mean, the professionals in this field are moral philosophers, and moral philosophers, the majority of them, are not theologically inclined. I mean, they tend to develop ideas, the simplest of all, the one we all know about is the golden rule, behave to others as you would wish they should behave to you. And moral philosophers have developed other such principles. Always oppose suffering. Always behave as if you didn't know whether you were going to be at the top of the pecking order or the bottom. These are all moral precepts which moral philosophers have developed. Now, it's a genuinely difficult question why any individual should wish to follow such moral precepts. If I ask myself, I'm actually a very moral person, I think, and I'm sure most of you are too. If I ask myself why I don't steal, why I pay my taxes, why I do all the things that keep society going, I suppose it's a slightly irrational feeling that I wouldn't wish to live in the kind of society where people behave in the sort of ways that I wouldn't wish them to behave in, and therefore I shouldn't behave in those ways either. Now, that isn't entirely rational, because if I behave in an antisocial way, then that doesn't actually stop anybody else doing the nice things to me that, maybe it does, and that could be the problem. But it is a genuinely difficult problem, why we are moral. All that I wish to assert today is that religion certainly doesn't help. Or if it does, I mean, if there's anybody here who thinks that they're moral purely because they're frightened of what God might do if they're not, I mean, that's a pretty contemptible reason to be moral. And I don't think we probably have much respect for people who only behave well because of the great surveillance camera in the sky. So I think that I'm sure all of us here are moral for better reasons than that, although I quite agree with the questioner, it's genuinely difficult to decide why we are. Thank goodness we are.
Good evening, Professor Dawkins. My name is Thomas Lukowski. I come from Thomas Jefferson's University, here to ask you a question. Richard, atheists have a PR problem. They are among the most distrusted minorities in the U.S. Many people equate atheism with immorality and pessimism. They ask, what good has atheism done? Atheism is so cold. I don't find any comfort from those who do not believe in God.